Rob Sanders, our fabulous producer. He excels every time he's at the console, so we appreciate his help and hard work. On the news line with us now, I'm glad to say Terry Diener's on the phone. Terry and I probably go back 25 years or so, working in radio as a former radio man, worked for a while at PPL, and he has always been a history buff, so interested in the very newest information in his career and the very oldest information as his hobby. So good morning, Terry. Thanks for checking in today.
Well, thanks, Mark. Thanks for having us. We do go back a long time. You were just a Cub reporter when I got to know you, so it's good to catch up with you once again.
Yeah, I think that was, 1983 or so when I started at the old, when McGee Enterprises owned a radio station in Bloomsburg. So, okay, so you wrote a book, a history book, A Deed of the Foulest Kind. Let's delve into your interest in history. How long have you been so interested? We know that you portray a particular historical character sometimes. Tell me about your interest in history.
Probably it goes back, Mark, to as early as my high school years, eighth grade. We had a course in Pennsylvania history, and that probably started me on my search for history. And inquiring minds want to know, being a radio reporter, an investigator, a researcher, the interest in getting some of the information locally piqued my curiosity. I've lived in this area for more than 43 years now and have been interested in Montour County history for a long time. And that got me on my journey to writing this book. I've been involved with the Historical Society and Genealogical Societies. I've written columns back in the 150th commemoration of the Civil War, a newspaper column weekly for the Danville News to mark Montour County soldiers' participation in the Civil War. So it does go back a long way, and this story I sort of stumbled upon in my research of others involving the poisonings of two people in Montour County that occurred in 1857, and that started me on my way to writing this book.
Well, tell me about this story. Give us a quick overview of A Deed of the Foulest Kind.
Yeah, Mark, in 1857, in May, actually, the story was spreading across the town of Danville, throughout the iron mills, throughout the company houses, throughout the community itself, that there had been a woman who died from poisoning. And Catherine Ann Clark had gone to Philadelphia to visit some friends in mid-April of 1857. She came back quite ill, and on May the 9th, just a couple of weeks later, she had died. And there was some suspicion around that she may have been poisoned. So some local doctors, Robert Symington, who later went on to be a Civil War surgeon, and several others, Dr. McGill, they did an autopsy, a postmortem, and found that she had arsenic in her system. And then they remembered that David Twiggs, the husband of Mary Twiggs, had died a couple of weeks earlier, April 19th, and because of the fact that the Twiggs and Clarks knew each other, they may have even lived in the same house or next to each other in company houses owned by the Montour Iron Mill, the local officials decided to dig up David Twiggs' body, and sure enough, they found out that he had been poisoned as well. Arsenic was the culprit. And so that began an investigation, and William John Clark, the husband of Catherine Ann, and Mary Twiggs, the wife of David Clark, were both indicted, eventually arrested for the murders of their spouses.
Oh, my God. And this would have sent shockwaves through the community?
I mean, yes. You know, small communities, Mark, well, probably big communities as well, but a town like Danville, this just was probably on the tongues of everybody in the iron mills, probably on the minds and in the conversations in the homes and in the bar rooms where the iron workers like to go after working a hard day in the mills. Yes, this was quite a little a gossip story. One quote was that I found that there were all sorts of flying reports that there was some intimacy between Mrs. Twiggs and William John Clark, and that they allegedly poisoned their spouses so they could be together.
Did you find any corroborating evidence in that regard, or was that, well, and I don't know how much of the latter chapters you want to disclose. You know, we don't want to do any spoilers here, so I'm not going to delve too far into the end of the book, but did you find more on that? Can you say that much?
Well, there were all sorts of twists and turns in this story, Mark, which finds it so intriguing. They both went to trial, and William John Clark was convicted of poisoning his wife. He was convicted in May of 1858. And I'm sure you're not going to be surprised that, well, here they were. They were arrested back in May of 1857. Why did it take them a year to come to trial? Well, believe it or not, Mark, attorneys got involved. Should that tell you enough? The attorneys got involved. There were filings to delay the trial. They were going to be tried together, Mary Twiggs and William John Clark, but the attorney for Mrs. Twiggs eventually asked for a separate trial, which was received. And by the way, she was convicted then a couple of months after Clark was. And so they were then given death warrants by the governor. Let me share you a couple of things.
Well, you can read an excerpt of the book, too, if you're interested.
Well, let me see here. Allegedly, Clark had gone to a local hardware store and bought arsenic to kill rats, allegedly, according to the clerks of Chalfont and Hughes, a local druggist. And now, one of the clerks was on the witness stand in Clark's trial, as was another one, who said that he sold arsenic to Mrs. Twiggs. One of the clerks later recanted that story, and the attorneys for Mrs. Twiggs grilled this young man, and he recanted and said no, he could not remember anymore. Another witness in the Clark trial said that at one time he had seen Mrs. Twiggs and Mr. Clark sitting next to a creek near her home with their arms around each other. But there was a lot of circumstantial evidence that convicted both Clark and Mrs. Twiggs. And really, that's all it was, circumstantial evidence. There was he said, she said, that type of thing. Allegedly, he wrote a letter to a friend at one time asking, for whatever reason, to buy the exact amounts of arsenic that he had allegedly purchased at the local store and bring it to the prison one day to give it to him. And for whatever reason, that was never really clarified. Why would Clark want the exact amounts of arsenic that he had purchased? What would that prove? Well, in his trial, Clark said, look, I never wrote that letter. I was framed. Later on, he went on to say, after his conviction in 1858, in July of that year, he issued a long statement as to why he was not guilty of the murder of his wife. And there was local newspaper accounts of those statements. He said, the reason I make this statement is first because I pity those who have been mistaken by false evidence to condemn the innocent. Secondly, because I believe the many Christians, servants of God and friends of justice throughout Montour and other counties who are obliged to hold me legally guilty and demand the punishment incurred while I am innocent. And so he went on and on and on. One thing that I found funny about that statement, Mark, was it was published in length by the local newspaper editors, and one of the enterprising editors of that day, D.H.B. Brower, who later went on to write the history of Montour County, offered William Clark's full statement in a pamphlet, selling it for 10 cents at the time of its publication. So,
well, this is like a pay-per-view.
Opportunity at that point. Interesting enough, both of these people went to the gallows to pay for the murders. I can say that there was an upswell of support to have Mrs. Twiggs' conviction overturned. The community came forth and there were numerous petitions to have her pardoned by William F. Packer, the governor of Pennsylvania at that time, who, by the way, in his early years was an old newspaper man. But J.W. Yeomans was a local clergy who attended to the spiritual needs of both Clark and in the latter parts of her stay in the prison for Mary Twiggs as well. I found down in the state archives in Harrisburg some interesting testimony and other letters. I found some letters that were written by Judge Alex Jordan on behalf of Mrs. Twiggs, saying that if he had been on the jury, he would not have convicted Mrs. Twiggs. There was not enough evidence to convict her. Also, just before the jury selection for Mrs. Twiggs, allegedly one of the jurors said, well, if William John Clark is going to hang for her murder, well, then she should deserve to be hanged too. And so the attorney for Mrs. Twiggs filed an appeal saying, look, this guy should not be on the jury. The man who allegedly made that statement was sworn in, and he denied it. So he was on the jury that convicted her of murder. Also understand, Mark, that yes, they were tried by a jury of their peers back in the 1800s, and of course not until 1921 did women allowed to serve on jury. So it was an all-male jury. Did that prejudice them in any way? William Clark said during his statements that he had enemies. He was basically saying that also in his statements, I'm a lot smarter than these other men around me, and I have enemies. I'm a member of the secret society, and all of this has piled up against me, and I did not do this. And
wow. Okay. Well, now, did this hubbub related to this continue in the decades ahead? They get executed. You mentioned that. So, and then what happens after that? This conversation continues, even though they're gone. Argument continues.
It really did die down, Mark. Over the years, of course, it was a part of the history books, and people did take some interest in it. But just like the headlines of today, well, what's new? We've told that story. Let's go on to the next big thing. And so it died down. Back in 1903, two local men stumbled upon the grave of Mrs. Twiggs out in Mayberry Township, Montour County. After she was hung, her brother Samuel McClintock, who was living at the time on a farm in Mayberry Township, took her body, took it out to the farm where he was renting, and buried her body. These two men stumbled upon her grave in 1903, and it had been disturbed. Some stones had been overturned, and it no longer looked like there was a coffin in the grave. So that adds to the mystery as well. What happened? Did somebody rob that grave? My research found that Samuel McClintock and his family later moved to Philadelphia. Also in the 1860 census, 2 years after after Mary Twiggs was hung, she had two children, a little girl and a little boy, and her brother took custody of these children. And they were part of the 1860 census. At least two children were, but it did not say that their names were Twiggs. It simply gave their first names and ages. Now, by that time, Samuel McClintock and his wife, whose name was also Mary, they were in their 40s. Now, did they have children before then, or were these actually the children of Mary Twiggs? So that's another thing that
another mystery.
I was never fully able to answer.
Do you know where Mary Twiggs' grave is today?
Well, that's another story in itself. I have tried to have people direct me to that grave, and I believe the property owners do not want anyone on their property to find it. I've put feelers out. People have said yes, well, they think they know where it is, and I've tried to contact a person who reportedly owns the land where the grave was, and I never received any response. So
okay,
it's out there, at least the place where she was buried is, but I did not find it.
And where was Danville's gallows when that happened?
Well, it was actually within the jail yard of the Montour County Prison. The one that is there now was not the one that was there when these people were hung in 1858, and it was a big walled prison. In my book, on the very front page, you'll see the picture of the prison as it stood in 1858, and hung inside.
Well, thank you so much. I cannot believe how much time has elapsed since we started chatting about this. I find it fascinating. I can't wait to read the rest of the book. I really appreciate your information on this. Tell me about where to get the book and a book signing real quickly here.
Sure. The book is available currently for those who would like to read e-books. It's available through Amazon.com, and they can download a Kindle app and purchase the book electronically. A lot of people like to have that actual paperback or book in their hands, and that's also available on Amazon.com. It can be published. I know a couple of people who've already ordered it and received it. And I am going to have a book signing on September the 19th from 11 until 1 at Basin Coffee Roasters in Danville. And I will be there to sign the books and talk a little bit about it. So 11 to 1, September the 19th, Saturday, and I'll be on hand, be anxious to meet the readers and try to answer some of the questions.
All right. Well, fabulous. Terry, fabulous work. Great job, especially on the yeoman letters, or the letters from the judge down there in Harrisburg. Good job. That's hard stuff to find. I appreciate it. Thanks for all the information. We're talking about A Deed of the Foulest Kind with a great author now and just a super community member and history buff, a man of great faith, and I'm glad to say a friend. I did the math. I probably started talking to you 37 years ago.
Wow. Wow, and we've been talking ever since, really.
Right, no argument there. All right, thank you so much, Terry. Thanks for your help.
Thank you, Mark.
That is Terry Diener, and he's a Montour County resident, author, and history buff. His book signing is on September 19th at the Basin Coffee House from 11 to 1, and the book's available on Amazon.